Finance and Revenue. Pretty quiet day here today in the old hearing room. We have three really big issues and important issues, and I wanted to say a few things as we go further. We're going to start with the Joint Resolution 202 and look at that, but we won't be able to complete it this morning. We don't have all of the necessary paperwork. In fact, Paul, we don't have the amendments.
Mr. Chair, we're waiting on the amendments and should have those later this morning.
All right. And I know we have a lot of people signed up, and we're not going to be able to get to you this morning. Okay? We might not even be able to get to everybody today. This bill was dropped into the Senate Revenue Committee this week, the fourth week of a one-month short session. It hasn't been vetted by the Legislative Fiscal Office, nor has it been vetted by a Revenue Committee. So it's a pretty tall order. So we're going to do our best and see where we go. And then we're going to move to the University Venture Development Bill. We do have the necessary paperwork for that. And I think we'll be ready after a short public hearing to consider it for a vote. And then we will, if there is time, begin a public hearing on the lodging tax. And we still need additional amendments and paperwork for that as well. So we are going to be in and out of this hearing room today. Probably we will recess until 2:30 after this first hour. We have 55 minutes to go, so we'll try to make the best use of our time. And I will begin opening a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 202.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify something?
With a short briefing from Mazza, Senator Edwards.
Could we clarify if we're going to stay on this first resolution for the entire first hour, because there are some people that are here to testify on the lodging tax or the University Venture Development Fund. Are we just staying on this for this first hour?
No, we're going to try to hit all three.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mazza?
Good morning, Chair. Members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 202 primarily tries to put into the election language in the coming election the include the ability to use lottery revenue for the purpose of expenditure on veterans, and it also attempts to put a percentage on that on that use. And I have in your documents here an SMS and revenue impact statement that basically talks about how these things work and the history of it. Today we have two dedications in the Constitution and percentages, and this basically would be the third one. The first one would be for the Education Stability Fund, and the other one is for parks, watersheds, and recreation, and this would be the third one.
That's it. Do you have a table that you wanted to show us? Or a chart?
I don't have a table or a chart on this bill.
Oh, okay.
I have another, but we have it. We have.
Well, I know we're going to hear from Legislative Revenue on this, and my hope is there we can see the lottery pie and what slices of that pie go
right
to where.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, actually, I did just to. I wanted to. There are certain documents that I have here for the revenue that comes through the lottery. So you would have a table B9 as we call it, but it's
the one up there. Yeah, we got it.
that's...
Those are easy to read, too.
Yes.
And those, what was that under?
This would be the revenue that you would see in the revenue forecast is updated every time you go to your quarterly revenue forecast. And these amounts basically come is what the traditional lottery gives you, video and so on. And then when you go to the bottom box where you see the allocation of resources, a lot of these allocations are not necessarily constitutional. These are both of a constitutional type and statute. So except the parks and natural resources, this gets about 15% by the constitutional, and also the Education Stability Fund that gets at 18%. So these two would have an increase in these allocations every time the revenue goes up, and they will have a decrease when the revenue goes down. The other ones are in statutes. That would be all the gambling addiction, the county fair, and the collegiate, intercollegiate funds. So these could, of course, at the discretion of the legislature, have different amounts. After all these allocations go satisfy and go out of the revenue stream, you would have the rest as discretionary amounts for the legislature to spend. Now, the spending on those discretionary amounts is also tied up by the constitutional language on economic development, education, and to restore watersheds and recreation with parks and so on. So that constitutional language allows the discretionary funds that are being or are left out of these different allocations to be expended on those. It has been traditionally that at the end of those different allocations, that the rest goes to education. However, you know, the different uses for the funds are also done with bonds, and the debt service for the bond takes a higher precedence just right after the allocations on the constitutional dedication amounts. So,
okay. We have some reps who are here if they'd like to come up and kick off our testimony. Senator Parrish, Evans.
So we have a panel set.
We need the reps first.
Roger that.
Thanks for speaking.
So.
Chair Hess, for the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, representing Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and South Salem. Due to time, which I understand you have many things to do today, I want to emphasize the fact that this bill is potentially the most consequential investment in veteran services in Oregon's history. I've sent you, and it is in the record, I assume you have probably some time today or now or later to look at the different elements. The first item I put in the record has to do with the number of veterans in each of your districts, to talk about the importance of how we try to help make sure that every veteran has the opportunity to receive the services and care that they have earned. The second, because of questions we had with the committee chair earlier in the week, have to do with the actual return on investments. I want to emphasize for the record that of the 2015-2017 general fund allocation, which was about $10 million for ODVA, that the return on investment can be calculated, that for every dollar of general fund investment in veteran services per biennium, we can estimate that the return is approximately $257 in federal compensation and pension. There's also, again, roll-ups from that in terms of once people are in the system, how it actually helps our state programs for getting folks off the Oregon Health Plan, et cetera. I do recognize that this committee has not had to deal with a lot of veterans issues. We actually thought that a veterans issue would be going to the Veterans Committee, which we had actually had a previous discussion about this issue earlier in the session, given the four-week timing. We regret that it didn't go the process we expected. Bottom line, in terms of this bill, is the following. We believe it's economic development. So we believe that it's not just the right thing to do for our veterans, but it's actually the smart thing to do. Show me a program in economic development that has the same return on investment in terms of outreach, in terms of impact in the neighborhoods. And I think I'd be surprised if there was one that can actually meet that scale. We have 5,000-ish veterans, hard to know right now because not all are in a system. We have about 5,000 veterans that tonight will be sleeping. Well, they don't know where they're going to be sleeping because they'll be homeless. Every day, about suicides among veterans that are at a higher than average rate to folks the same age. We know nationally that there are 22 suicides among veterans every day. I want to emphasize that's actually not just current era, that in fact Vietnam, Korea, World War II, Persian Gulf, and current era veterans are all included in those numbers. What we are asking for today, and again understanding the timing, the folks behind me are asking for a portion of the lottery set aside for outreach above the baseline of ODVA funding that can help link up and leverage every available federal dollar that is currently being left on the table. We can compare, and the slides that I would have had time to show you, but I do not today, would have shown that Oklahoma and Oregon, that are comparable states in terms of the number of veterans, Oklahoma is currently bringing in excess of $500 million, more, because of their aggressive outreach efforts. We believe, based on the number of veterans that the VA currently sees, about 100,000 in terms of what they recognize in their system, that currently brings in about $1.3 billion per biennium. If we reach out to the 230,000 to 250,000 veterans that are currently out there not in the VA system, that could potentially be as much as $4 billion into the state, into every neighborhood, into every school district across the state. It has been mentioned and talked about that this may be a competing priority for both economic development and education. I have a letter in your packet from OEA saying that they are neutral on the bill because they recognize that it's not inherently any more of a competition to education than it would be to agriculture or anything else. The fact of the matter is, Oregon has a problem. We have veterans coming home without the services they need. We don't have large active duty bases to provide those services. It is a federal responsibility to keep faith with the men and women we send into harm's way. And the bottom line is, whether or not it's a state priority or not, we can sit here and watch things go by, or we can stand up and make a fundamental difference that is, in fact, the smart economic plan to do so. So, with all respect, I ask you to please move this bill and recognize that 2% of the lottery, or if it has to be less, that the money is always for outreach and programming, not for supplanting. But the money we put right now can save lives, and it will actually transform rural areas, especially around the state of Oregon, because of the way veterans live. I know that you are limited on time. I ask that the folks that have spent time in uniform get an opportunity somehow, whether this morning or this afternoon, to share their stories, just as we have listened to stories from every other category of Oregonian for the last 4 weeks. Thank you.
Representatives, yeah. I want you to be conscious of our time here. We've got a room full of people and two other pretty...
Thank you. Senator Haas, Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. I am also the sponsor of the Oregon Veterans Lottery Bill in a petition initiative at 5%. Just so you know, that is co-sponsored by your former colleague, Senator Martha Schrader. 3 years ago, we brought HJR 29, which had 59 sponsors in this body, at 5%. And we're here today talking about two and whether or not we're going to maybe even amend that down less. So 59 is nearly a constitutional majority of this body, 19 senators, five of your Democratic colleagues on that bill. This is so important. And, you know, I'm just going to share a personal story, and you're going to hear other people's personal stories. But 4 years ago, my husband separated from the Oregon National Guard. He spent 17 of his 23 years in the military serving the state of Oregon. So these veterans aren't just people who joined up and went away and left Oregon. These are people who have served here. They have fought in our fires, our floods, here locally on our own soil. That when they've been called to Katrina or called to Iraq, they have done what our state and our governor has asked them to do, not just what Uncle Sam has asked them to do. And it is 4 years after his service, and he still cannot get out of the VA the right way. He's 80% service-connected disabled. When I started this session this year, he told me on a Sunday night, right before I came in the morning, that his labs had popped positive for lymphoma again. Connected to his time in Iraq, exposed to sarin gas and depleted uranium. And so, all of these people have a story. There are 350,000 veterans in Oregon. They have lost limbs and wives and children. Because when they come home, they're not always all right. And sometimes that is really hard for families. And they didn't ask to get sick. They asked to serve, and they said they would, but they didn't ask to lose their, you know, their limbs. They did not ask to come home with cancer-causing exposure. They did not come home to ask for any of that. And usually these committees, when we have these veterans' bills, they are empty. Because they don't come here asking for something. We are doing that on their behalf. And so if my husband, who's a colonel and who was an inspector general and a West Point grad, cannot get through the VA the right way, what, how do you think a homeless veteran is going to get through the VA the right way? 4 years in the process. When you hear the average is 39 months in our state, that is not a lie. Those headlines are real. So that's what my session's been like, is waiting for lab results and waiting to understand, is this the year that, you know, I lose my spouse? So I ask that you move this at 2% because it is a compromise from what these folks have been out there doing for 3 years, gathering signatures. A World War II veteran should not have to stand in front of a Bi-Mart asking and petitioning their government for support. Thank you.
Chair Haas, committee members, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And you'll hear more stories. I'm not a veteran, and the only veteran in my families are gone now. They were World War II veterans. This is an important bill, this resolution. This is very important. I was working on this 29 last time, too, with Julie. And our committee has heard many, many stories and how important it is. We are just barely touching 10% of the qualifying veterans in Oregon for services, and this will be a huge help. So I'm here today to just testify in favor of this, 110%. So if you can give this your attention, and please give it the 2% if you can. Thank you very much.
For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, Medford. I am a Vietnam veteran. I am a partially disabled Vietnam veteran from Agent Orange. I found out about this quite by accident. No one came and told me about it. I knew nothing about it until I went to the VA, and they started quizzing me, and they found out that I was a product of Agent Orange because I was in country, and they were spraying it around our bases. So I've also had two other people that I've steered to the VA that have had prostate problems, had removal, and those people now are getting disability, and rightfully so. When we put people in harm's way, we owe them. They don't owe us, and they never ask for anything, but we need to reach out and educate these people. Example, my stepfather was a Korean War veteran. He passed away, and she, for all this time, didn't understand that she had a pension. We just got her pension thanks to the Oregon DVA. These are the kinds of things that we're talking about here. It's people that have slipped through the cracks, that they were educated at one time when they were given their DROs, and then they forgot about it. So we need to reach out to these people. And is it an economic factor? Yeah, I would say 257-1 is pretty good. Pretty good return. So I urge that we don't cut the amount, and I also urge that we pass it, because veterans remind me of a group that's going to go camping in a RV trailer. They get it ready. They're sitting in the RV trailer. They packed all their stuff, but the pickup never comes to hook up to them and leave. That's what we need to do. We need to get them going. I thank you.
Chair Hass, just one last comment for Representative Lively, who could not make it. He is the chair of the Veterans Committee. He wanted to be here, along with the Vice Chair Boone and Vice Chair Esquivel, to emphasize that all the members of the Veterans Committee are not just supporting of the bill, they're actually co-sponsors, because they recognize this is something that has been in the works for 5 years, and it's time.
Representative Evans.
Sir.
Some devil's advocate questions.
Sure.
There's no ballot title for this bill. We talked about that earlier.
Senator.
There's no ballot title.
Do you want me to respond, sir?
Please.
Okay. Chair Hass, we actually have a ballot title drafted. We did not get it into the system because we wanted to make sure it was perfect. And in the rush and hush of 3 weeks, we understood from discussing with folks who have done this process before that if you rush it, fine, you can do that, but that there's actually no rush to be able to work with the Attorney General's office and actually get it prepared for the fall ballot, that that's happened before, that that's a normal process. That's what I was informed.
Implementing language, which also usually accompanies these kinds of constitutional amendments, that spells out where the money goes and who gets it. Right now you have potentially $26 million going somewhere, but it's not spelled out here. And I was just...
Senator Hess, if I could respond to that.
Sure.
We actually worked with Legislative Council on developing implementing language. After discussions with them, the answer was that ultimately the way this bill would be implemented is through the Ways and Means process, that there wasn't a need for implementing language because we wrote this specifically not to go straight to ODVA or any rules like that, but to be set into a fund that then the Ways and Means process, through the normal deliberative process, could emphasize veterans' services, but not just for ODVA, for education, for housing, for human services, for transportation. It was designed to be flexible because in the past, when we had other bills, the concern was you're taking authority away from Ways and Means, and Ways and Means want the ability to decide where it goes. We support that. We just want to make sure that the people of Oregon are given the opportunity to set aside 2% for veterans' outreach and services, however that may look. We have, again, if there's time, representatives' faces to put with the stories on how housing, especially for women veterans, transportation to and from care, education completion, student veterans that are on college campuses that right now aren't able to complete. We have programs to do all of those things. We just haven't ever had the set-asides to do it. That's why it's written the way it is, sir.
You brought up the point that this is a federal responsibility.
Yes, sir.
And I agree with you. And I would probably also agree with you that we haven't talked about this, that the federal government's response to our veterans have been somewhere between disgraceful and embarrassing.
Yes.
But it is a federal responsibility. States traditionally have to pay for schools and paved roads and state police and prisons. Is it fair to now put this burden to take care of American veterans, a federal responsibility to take that on as well?
Chair Hass, here's my answer to that. I would say that the federal government is dysfunctional on many levels, and quite frankly, in 1990, when Measure 5 passed, and later in 96 when Measure 4750 went through, we ended up picking up more of local responsibilities. The state now spends a lot more on education than you ever used to because of the changes in the tax system. My answer is this. Things happen. I can't fix the federal government, but I'm not going to sit here and do nothing when thousands of veterans every night are living without a place to live. They can't get the care. I took a commission to the United States, which is far more important than any oath I took as a legislator. I have young men and women that I know that did not come back in the same shape that they were. You go to the corrections that are currently of the state of Oregon, and you find veterans there in large numbers. I believe it is a federal responsibility. Absent the federal responsibility, those citizens that are American soldiers are Oregon soldiers too. So I believe it is a responsibility, especially when, and here's the most important point, if you don't care, if you don't have any interest in picking up the federal responsibility just to do the right thing, look at the dollars and cents. Every dollar invested in veterans outreach, we can show, brings back in excess of $200+. There is no other economic development program that I know of that does that. So even if it shouldn't be done because it's a federal responsibility, it's a smart economic development investment, and I believe that's why the state of Oregon should do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I know those are devil's advocate's questions, and
yes, sir.
I appreciate you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I guess if we're going to send our boys and girls in harm's way and the federal government won't take care of them, You can't, we just can't stand on the sidewalk and watch them. We've got to get involved with them, and we have to take care of those people.
I don't disagree with that. Any other questions, Senator Edwards?
Well, I would just like to thank you for how you've constructed that in response to the question of the chair. I've always been, so as a former Ways and Means member, I was on Ways and Means for 5 years. I was chair of the Natural Resources Budget Committee, and as chair, I actually opposed the dedication to Parks and Natural Resources because I disagreed with the premise that things would be dedicated in the Constitution rather than going through the public budgeting process. But I really, Representative Evans was, before he was Representative Evans, has been working on this issue for years in the Capitol and first walked me through all the numbers and I do think, and that was, I think, back in 2009,
yes, sir.
In my office when I first became familiar with this issue. And these type of investments are how you get the federal dollars into the state. And so to the question about isn't this the federal government's responsibility, it is. But if it's done well, we are using Oregon dollars to make sure that the federal dollars get in to the state, to Representative Evans' point earlier. So, Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to all the veterans in the room, I'd like to extend my gratitude for your service. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. Question.
Sir.
How do we coordinate our program with the federal government outside the money? Okay, I understand the money. Is there coordination, though, between the state of Oregon and Veterans Affairs, and how does that work?
Chair Hass, Senator, the answer is yes, but it's not as much as it used to be because the federal government, again, has backed away from things. In 2005, the state of Oregon was a leader in putting together the reintegration team and a leader in bringing ODVA, the USVA, and folks from across the regions. In fact, Ryan Fisher, who is on our panel to be speaking later, can talk to how we've been having integrated conversations because of some of those efforts. We have, through the network that is represented here, the United Veteran Groups of Oregon, the ODVA, county VSOs, which is a huge piece of this puzzle, we have a network right now that knows where the dollars need to go. We have the communication already. We just have never had access to the funds to roll out these programs that we can provide through metrics, will make money for the state, and do good things. So we actually are better positioned than many states to be able to maximize this type of program because of the work that's been done over the last 10 years.
Also, for all the veterans that don't get to testify today, because we are short on time, my office is open to you if you want to go up to the fourth floor and talk to my chief of staff, who's a veteran, and he will convey that to me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for your service and for your advocacy on behalf of everyone in this room and everyone in the state that needs these services.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ken Rocco still here? Ken, you want to give us a little briefing on how this works, how this would work?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Ken Rocco with the Legislative Fiscal Office. I was asked to come here today and just explain the budgeting process for lottery funds. So what we do, you see over there in the column, the bottom part of the table where it says allocation of resources. The first thing we do is we look at the constitutional dedications, and right now you have two of those. You have 18% going to the Education Stability Fund and 15% going to the Parks and Natural Resources Fund. So we have to accommodate those first because they're constitutional. The next thing we have to do is figure out how much debt service on lottery-backed bonds, how much money is needed for that. And that comes out of that other legislatively adopted allocation line at the bottom. In the current budget, there's approximately $225 million out of that total for debt service. for lottery bonds. The next thing we do is we look at the statutory distributions, and those are the county economic development line, the collegiate athletic and scholarships, gambling addictions, and county fairs. And so we have to accommodate those in the budget. The next thing we do then is typically we figure out how much the Oregon Business Development Department needs for its programs, and those are primarily the economic development portion of the lottery resources. And we also have to figure out what the governor's office needs for primarily the regional solutions program in the governor's office. So we determine those amounts, and then what is left traditionally goes to the state school fund. And currently, in the current budget, that's about $408 million.
If we were to put another slice of pie, if you will, into that pie of 1% or 2% or whatever it may be, where would that come from? Where would that crowd, or where would it?
So if you include another constitutional dedication, as I said, we deal with those first, so that would come off the top. And so as it goes through this process of getting down to the bottom, you would end up with fewer lottery resources for the state school fund. Now, in reality, though, you have to realize that that number is probably one of the most important budget numbers that the legislature deals with every 2 years. So that number is set, and then we find a way to pay for it. So it's a combination of general fund and lottery resources. So in reality, if the lottery resources go down, we just have to put more general fund in to hit that number. So
all right.
That's the process that we do. Ultimately, though, to the extent that a constitutional dedication is greater than what you would normally put into that particular program, then at some part of the budget somewhere, there's going to be less dollars for a program. So that's just the reality of dedication of resources.
Right. The reality here, you're saying, is effectively there would be less money available for the school fund.
From lottery resources, yes.
Would it be possible to change this legislation or direct the budgeteers and the Ways and Means Committee to still do this, yet hold education harmless?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it certainly would, because, like I said, that number is set early in the session. The agreement is the state school fund will be this amount, and then what we do is we figure out almost the last thing we do in session is figure out how much lottery is left over to go to the education. And what we do is we just balance it between general fund and whatever lottery is left after we do all those other things I talked about.
Okay. Questions of Mr. Rocco? Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I understand you to say, and tell me if I've got this right, the education fund will not be harmed because we'll just take it from some other place. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I think ultimately that would be what would happen. But there would be overall some program
would not have
resources.
We just don't know which one.
Yeah, at this point.
But
it means there's less lottery resources for the state school fund.
But we need that direction in statute or in a bill that we don't have in front of us yet.
Mr. Chair, we were discussing some options with on the House side of that Representative Evans mentioned, that the implementing language, which you could do if this is referred and passes, then the next session you could implement language. And the idea that we offered was that it would be broader, not just to ODVA or the Department of Veterans Affairs, but to veterans programs in general, which could include housing programs or health services programs, other things like that. And that would need to do that in implementing language. And this is the same thing that happened with the original ballot measure 66, which set up the parks and natural resources. The implementing language was passed in the following session and determined how the money would be distributed.
The questions?
Yeah, question.
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
But now you don't?
No, I do again.
And now you do again?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
So, Ken, could you give us some sort of perspective of how much we spend currently on programs that would qualify under this? The reason I ask is in the parks and natural resources world, where we have a similar there is a dedication. Everybody thinks that those programs are flush with money because there's that dedicated 15%, but the actual need is, you know, the actual need is this big. The 15% that's dedicated from lottery funds takes up a portion of that, but there's still a bunch of need that's still not met. And so educating legislators about that, it takes some time to explain that to legislators, that just because there's dedicated funding doesn't mean that they're flush with money. And so I'm wondering, what's the universe of spending on veterans programs, and how this dedication of lottery funding would, notwithstanding the benefits of all the federal funds coming in, which is why I'm a big supporter of this, because of all of that, not the only reason why I'm supportive of that, but one of the budgetary reasons why it makes sense. I'm trying to get some sort of a sense of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, I don't have the total amount spent on all veterans activities in the state. We do know that right now the budget, the general fund budget for the Department of Veterans Affairs is, for this biennium, is $12.7 million of general fund. To the extent that veterans receive services through housing programs, and we don't break that out in the budget, so that's not. I think the other issue with dedication is, for example, as you say, on the Parks and Natural Resources side, when Measure 76 was passed to re-up Measure 66, there were some additional fine-tuning of dedications in that ballot measure, which require that 65% of the money goes in the form of grants to people, non-state agencies, for stream restoration and other riparian habitat improvement. And again, by doing that, that restricts the amount of money that can be used for other important parks and our natural resource programs. It's just, it's just one of those things that in a recessionary period, when you have to look around for money to pay for troopers, prison guards, medical service workers, constitutional dedications do not allow you to have that flexibility. And from being from the budget office, we generally are, as you mentioned, you were initially opposed to Measure 76 changes. We're just generally opposed to dedications in general, because we believe it's the legislature's duty to come in and pass a balanced state budget based on the priorities of current priorities, and not using dedications of resources.
Well, so, and I know we're short on time, but so I'm wondering: does the dedication in this bill increase the amount of? I mean, because it would provide certainty, but if it doesn't actually increase, and I haven't talked with Representative Evans about this, then there wouldn't be a point to doing it. There would be a point in that it would provide certainty and it can never go down, but I would hope that we'd be spending more on veteran services by passage of this bill. And I'm getting a head nod that yes, it would be more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, I think you would, because a 2% dedication based on the numbers for the next biennium would be about $26 million.
Okay.
I think it's dependent on how the implementing language is written to see how widely that can be spread.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it, Joe. As you can see, there are some issues here. This is not as easy as it seems, and we as I mentioned, we just got this bill. Today is the day we're trying to wind down this session. And so this is not an ideal situation for us to rush through a bill like this. But when I look around this room, I see people who have probably experienced less than ideal situations in the service of our country. So we'll do our best throughout the day to try to take some action on this if we get the necessary documents, and to see and hear as many of these people as we can. That's all we can do.
Okay. Let me simplify this really quickly. Go back one slide, please. One full slide. Right there. Stop right there. This is the present program that we have. We started in the 40s. Actually, we started World War One. How we get federal benefits is very simple. You have to get an individual veteran to do a packet and prepare that packet and submit it to the federal government. That's how you do it. That's what the VSO program is all about. If you look at the economic impact slide that's up here right now, what we started in 2003 and 2005 is figured out as Representative or Senator, then Representative, but Senator Edwards knows, is trying to get those packets moving faster. Because every packet you put in, then you pull benefits back in that supplement or eliminate state grant money from DHS, OHA, so on and so forth. There's the slide from 2003. Up to 2014, and you can say we've gained about $900 million in health care. And if you scroll to the compensation, either up or down two slides to the compensation, we have accomplished that by adding trinket money each session into there to get more packets filled out. That's how it works. What we're saying here and what the purpose and the veterans are saying is if we really want to get the money that's on the table, which is the low-hanging fruit, which $3 billion more, is we got to do packets faster, and we got to help veterans in the interim to stabilize them so we can go get the packets done. It's a very simple process, unfortunately. The government, federal government, makes it very, very complex, and that's what we're really discussing at this point. Every one of those packets we get gets us more money that we can then spend that state money elsewhere.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. I'm going to have to close the public hearing on HVR 202, and we will pick this up later. And I have to move to a public hearing on public hearing and work session on House Bill 4072. A quick update from Kyle.
Don't hit your cell phone. I'm waiting for the day.
4072 is ready to go, right?
Yeah.
Pinching for Chris.
Thanks.
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this up.
Okay. Thank you.
Have any help? Thanks.
Thank you. Go get some coffee in my office. You need some coffee, go to the fourth floor.
You're burning time.
Michael will be there.
Started in 1987. Yeah. I didn't get my benefits until 2012. Four tour combat vet of Vietnam with a 12 Bravo MOS.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We need all the
cavalry. There you go.
I sure hope so.
The big red one?
We're doing our best.
2% or more. We need it, folks. Thank you. Appreciate your service.
There are only two of us who are paying.
Okay. Dr. Warner.
Mr. Chair, before you, committee, you have HB 4072, which came to you from the through the House Revenue Committee. This bill, you reviewed the substance of this in the context of the tax credit bill. It involves the University Venture Development Fund. What 4072 does is this credit actually sunsetted the beginning of this tax year. The 4072 would extend it through January 1 of 2022. It does change the structure of the credit a bit. Under previous law, it was a $60,000 credit spread over, or 60% credit spread over 3 years. Now it'll be consolidated into a single year with a carry forward, so the taxpayers will be able to carry it forward. It does increase the amount that an individual taxpayer could contribute. It does, however, maintain the existing program cap of $8.4 million, and we estimate that cap, which is about $4 million now available to reach that cap, would take a period of time to reach that level based on historical use. And so if you look on our revenue impact statement, we're estimating it'll be an impact of about $500,000 in 16-17, and then on up gradually increases to about $1.8 million by 19-21. This is set up as a revolving fund with a cap so that there, if investments end up paying off, there is a repayment back to the general fund. Historically, since 2008, we've had about a $500,000 repaid to the general fund. We do have a bit of a comment about secondary effects. We don't incorporate those formally into the revenue impact estimates, but I'm sure you'll hear some presentation about potential impact on jobs. And, of course, if these end up generating jobs, those secondary effects can end up increasing revenue through the income tax payments.
Thank you.
Senator Haas, thanks for your time today. I know you're under a tight schedule here, so we're going to try to shorten this as quick as we can, but we're certainly available to answer any questions here or after. I'm Brian Wall, Assistant Vice President.
Brian, can I interrupt you just for a second to get Rep. Olson a chance to join you? And Rep. Olson is an expert in brevity and understands the need for timely passage.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Brian, for hitting this off. Thanks, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative out of the Albany area. And, you know, I'm just quickly with the University Venture Development Fund, UVDF. It is one of the neatest opportunities for us, really, to take higher education and marry it up with business, to be very creative with that. I know Brian's going to share a little bit more of the nuts and bolts with you. I do want to share one. Actually, to be truthful with you, I could share tons of success stories. I really could with what's happened since we moved forward with this in 07. But the one I do want to share with you comes from the Portland Business Journal, and it was OHSU teaming up with GE Healthcare. And this was a quote, that through this collaboration of OHSU and GE Healthcare, this will apply leading-edge medical technology to a number of clinical challenges for which there is an unmet need. And where they were wanting to go with this whole thing, and this was another one where they tied in with the Knight Cardiovascular Center, was to try to finally come to a point of finding an artificial heart, because we have 3,000 folks in the country right now that are needing heart transplants. There's only 2,000 donors. So by marrying up with this innovative concept of businesses plugging in and helping higher ed to come up with solutions, OSU, U of O, many of the other universities have great stories. This is really an opportunity for us to jump in and continue. So I'm going to stop right there.
Okay. Please go on. I'll introduce myself. Brian Wall, Assistant Vice President, Research Commercialization, Industry Partnerships at Oregon State University. And this is, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Greetings. This is, my name is Dexter Gauntlet, Chief Operating Officer of Sweet Sense Inc.
So, in the interest of time, we'll walk through this presentation very quickly. And again,
example.
Feel free to ask any questions, of course. I do represent all of the universities that you see on this table here. And this is a summary slide of what we'll walk through. The complexity around this is we've had a number of questions on how this works, primarily because it's the only tax credit that actually has the ability to kind of become evergreen and repay itself. So we'll walk through very briefly how donations come in, flow, how universities utilize those to help create the startup companies, high-growth startup companies that turn into jobs and then continue to repay this to turn it into an evergreen approach. And in short, since 2007, it took a little while to kind of get up and ramp in fundraising, but we have raised just over $7.7 million in donations. That translates into the 60% tax credit, which would be a loss to the Treasury of $4.7 million. But with that, we launched collectively 27 companies. And how that worked is we utilized those funds with guidance from an external advisory council of entrepreneurs and investors to support research and direct it in areas that will target an end result of commercialization success and attract entrepreneurs to then license innovations from the universities. We also use those funds to support entrepreneurial endeavors like accelerators, interns, and others. Those companies have produced approximately 270 high-wage jobs, and these jobs are, you know, are in the high-growth science and technology fields. So they're larger pay than the average state Oregon State positions. And this is the secondary effect that was mentioned earlier. Those jobs have produced a significant amount of tax benefit back to the state that's not necessarily counted in this tax credit. And when the companies are successful, they actually are selling product or providing services. They're producing revenues. They provide those revenues, a portion, back through the universities under a license agreement, which we turn around, according to statute then, and provide back to regenerate tax credits. So we're paying the tax credits down and then regenerating tax credits. So the $4.7 million loss is actually reduced to $4.2 million at this point in time, and we're estimating we'll continue to pay that off and regenerate continued tax credits to keep this program alive. So in short, the ask is to continue to support the $8.4 million, which would produce $14 million in donations, produce additional companies that will create these jobs, produce revenues back to the universities, which will continue to generate tax credits, and make this into an evergreen fund where we won't come back and ask for additional tax credits. We may come back and ask for an extension and show the results at that point in time that we've continued to do what we said we'll do here. Our estimates are, you know, if you stop right now, there'll still be a significant impact in the economy. Those jobs and those companies will continue to exist, but we have the ability to continue what was started in 2007 with the $8.4 million in total and actually leapfrog that and make a significant step in creating more companies and more jobs. And the summary is it retains the total tax credit limitation of 8.4, same as 2007, sunsets in 2022, and enables an easier way to transfer some of these tax credits between the universities that weren't in existence previously. And so with that, I'll turn it over to SweetSense to tell you a little bit about a company who has benefited starting from these UVDF funds.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, my name is Dexter Gauntlet with SweetSense, Inc. I'm Chief Operating Officer. Two of our employees have previously testified here in support of extending the UVDF, so thank you for welcoming me here again. Our company, SweetSense, Inc., manufactures remote monitoring solutions for water, energy, and infrastructure projects, particularly focused on the developing world. We are an Internet of Things company, an IoT company, that has successfully spun out of Portland State University's Sweet Lab, Sustainable Water, Energy, and Environmental Technologies Laboratory, about 3.5 years ago. We received about $50,000 in UVDF funding then at a very early stage in our company's growth and development, which was a very critical time for us because it enabled us to take the technology out of the lab very quickly in direct response to demand that we saw in the marketplace. It enabled us to get about a year, maybe even 2 years, advanced step on any competition in this sector. And as a result of that, we're leaders in our sector today. We've bootstrapped our company since it was spun out of the lab 3.5 years ago, and now we have 8 employees here in the U.S., most of them here in Oregon. We have a couple, 2 or 3 overseas, and our revenues this year, depending on how a couple of deals in Ethiopia go this week, will range between $500,000 to $1 million this year. We closed recently a $1.8 million 5-year deal in Kenya, this at the end of last year, to design an operations and maintenance system for the government of Kenya with IBM. Similarly, we're about to close a very similar deal, as I mentioned, in Ethiopia with AECOM, a major international engineering firm there for a similar size program. It's important to point out that we have all of our sensors manufactured here in Oregon. It's Pacific EMS, I'm down here all the time in Salem, who does all of our contract manufacturing, and it's Polycast and Tigard, who did our injection molded box enclosure for our sensor unit. We've had a fantastic working relationship with Portland State University. They're a key partner for our company, and we appreciate the growth. And in closing, UVDF is one of the type of programs that will enable PSU and Oregon and the region to compete against an increasingly challenging market in places like the Bay Area and Massachusetts. Not only that, but also to retain the existing entrepreneurs that are really starting to grow from our perspective in academia, but want a way to spin out their technologies and to form companies like SweetSense. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we wish you the best of luck, and the state wishes you the best of luck, not just for you and your company, but for our revenue picture. Questions of our panel? Thank you, Representative Olson, for keeping this going, okay? And for your time. Well, we were at that point. I don't know what the committee's wishes are to keep going with this.
If there's just one or two, let's blow this bill out of here, okay? Whoever else needs to testify, let's just be done. And I think there's a couple more to testify.
I have Jody Weiser. I don't know if she's still here.
Yeah, she's here.
There she is.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon, and you're getting a document that would be unlike something I would want to put on the screen, the chart that you're seeing. So the University Development University Venture Development Fund is a compelling story. It's actually something I might donate to. It is really, it makes sense as something that one would donate to. But last year, you looked at your priorities and you let it end. And I think you haven't really seen any more convincing arguments this time. The numbers have changed, but it's the same arguments you heard last time. The reason I think that it hit low priority is because there really is no rational reason to subsidize this kind of donation differently than we subsidize other kinds of donations. If I endowed a chair for a science department or paid to build an athletic field or donated $1 million for scholarships, I would get a tax deduction. With this program, I get a tax deduction and I get a tax credit. And it doesn't really make sense. When I first testified about this bill, I talked about the fact that it's changing what is a three-year tax credit, a tax credit you must use over three or more years, to a one-year tax credit. That takes the risk of not being alive or not having taxes due away, and the time value of money is much increased. So you're creating a nice benefit for donors, but no new benefit for the public. And so I recommended that it be changed from a 60 to a 55% tax credit. My numbers aren't the same as the donors who would make $1 million donation, but like them, I'm sure my taxes go up and down. Sometimes they are zero and sometimes they're $50. And so if I buy a tax credit that's good over 3 years, I don't really know when I'm going to get to use it all, or if I'll even get to use it all within 5 years. Probably so, but not sure. And so it is a real benefit if I get to use it in one shot. And so reducing the percentage makes sense. I also was concerned about the fact that there doesn't seem to be any reporting to tax authorities with this bill or the IDA or the Children's Commission donations, and that seems inappropriate, particularly when you're raising what is a much smaller donation to a tax credit that could be as much as $600,000 in a single year. That is definitely a benefit that the recipient is receiving.
Ms. Weiser, let me just ask you one. You did bring us a chart. I showed it to Paul about the $1 million donation and how this works out. Dr. Warner, is that how that would work?
Mr. Chair, the chart that Jody gave the committee shows that if you donate a certain amount and get a credit for it, then you could deduct that same amount on your federal return. And in almost all circumstances I could think of, that would not be correct. The credit would be something you would have received in return for your donation. So really the only amount you could deduct on your federal return would be if you donated $100, you could only deduct the $40, which would be the amount after the credit. So that would be normally the way you would the two would interact. Mm-hmm. Now there's always an issue of how much auditing goes on, how closely that's tracked at a compliance level, but certainly that would be the case. If you get a credit, that's obviously a transfer you've received as a result of that donation.
Okay. So I went the other evening, I went to the website of Portland State, and I was going to donate $100 to see
That's the chart Paul's referring to.
Right. I went to their site to donate $100 to see what paperwork I would get, what would be generated to me. I didn't need to donate $100 because I found this chart on the website advising this approach to the donation. And I've heard that there are CPAs who encourage people to use this approach to the donation. Certainly, Portland State is encouraging people to use this approach to the donation. When I make donations and you make donations, we generally get statements that say either you did or didn't receive certain goods or services in exchange for your donation and what the value of those goods and services are. If you go to Goodwill, they give you a card and you get to say what you think they're worth. But, you know, you get that kind of statement all the time. And, in fact, on the donation that I made to OCPP this year, because my donation is coming from the Schwab Charitable Fund, where I already got a donation credit when I made my donation 5 years ago, you know, of a large hunk of money there to create a foundation, basically. It says, OCPP did not provide you with any goods or services in consideration of your contribution. If your contribution was made via Network for Good or another donor-advised fund, your contribution was made to the donor-advised fund. In other words, not to us. Please use your receipt from them for tax purposes. That's not the kind of advice Portland State is giving to their donors in this case. I suggested in the House Revenue Committee that we should be providing 1099s for the tax credits we give. That is probably not the right information return to send to the IRS, but we should be doing something, and we haven't been, either for the gain that people make when they purchase tax credits or for the donation tax they get, the tax credit they get when they make donations. As I thought, I was trying to figure out what I was going to say as I was driving here today. How do I characterize my feelings about this? And I thought, what does Phil Knight and Tim Boyle and Gert Boyle and U.S. Bank's, you know, top administrators, what do they think about the state when they see us doing something this foolish? We have tax credit. We have donations that we give tax credits for 70 and 75% for. You actually make money donating money to an Oregon institution. That is not right. It's simply not right. And it's the kind of way we show the public that you can't trust the government to be logical, to do the right thing, and that we benefit rich people. We let them choose where their tax money goes while everybody else is left paying for things they don't believe in, even. So I think that this should be left on the table. I think it needs to cycle down. And it is true the fund gives money out to the general fund, and as soon as they give $100 to the general fund from profits from the royalties that they receive from one of their successful businesses, they can offer another $100 worth of tax credit. So the general fund isn't getting paid back. It's just rebuilding the tax credit fund, really. So it's not really circular. We're getting the income taxes of the individuals, yes. But the general fund isn't getting paid back from the investment we're making by giving out tax credits to donors. And that's what we're really doing. We're giving tax breaks to donors.
Questions? Thank you, Joey. Okay. Questions of Paul on this, or any other questions before we go into a work session? We're in a work session before we take a motion.
Are we in a work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4072 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 4072 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote yes on this, but I have some reservations. Like all tax credits, I think that one of the things that we do is we pass along the debt to future generations, and if it's something we believe in, we should give them the money, and if we don't believe in it, then let's not do it. But this is one of those. So.
Sure. Just for the record, because DOR is sitting in the room, if there is a university by chance that's encouraging tax fraud, I guess the university will sink or swim on its own, and the Department of Revenue's responsibility is to audit them. So I'm fine.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Are there any? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bechtier.
Yes.
Senator Edwards.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yes.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. The measure passes, goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation.
I'm not carrying it, Mr. Chair.
I was looking down the hallway.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Edwards will be the carrier. We will stand in recess until 2:30 and take up lodging and vets to see if we can take action on either one of those. We are back in session, and we are going to open a work session and public hearing on HDR 202A.
I'll do it, Mr. Chair.
And we have 22 minutes to do two bills here, so we need to be very timely. Senator Boquist, you have some representatives.
But
you think
I think we can get a panel of three of the veterans up here to make their case. You can go. We'll take a female veteran, too.
Well, she's got a case.
Tina, there's another female behind her. Do you want her to speak for you? Or?
Oh, you want to go?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Yep.
No, you
have a more powerful story.
What, Tina, you sit down. Bud, you sit down with me, and you can go up there.
Okay. There you go.
Bring up 2:30.
Okay.
Good.
Okay.
Clock is ticking.
Okay.
And we need to hear the best case we've got, and then I'll tell everybody the bad news. Which is, we're going to move the bill.
Welcome.
Do you want me to go first? Good afternoon, committee and Chair Hass. I so appreciate this today, and everybody knows me through the Veterans Committee and through this legislature as a veteran. But I came here today to tell, I don't tell a lot about my personal story, but I'm going to do it today, and I'm going to read it because it's pretty hard for me. So I am a veteran of the Desert Storm era and several deployments underneath my belt. I have been diagnosed with fairly severe PTSD. I still can function, and I spend most of my decade fighting and having random emotional erratic episodes, just chalking it up to drinking most of my life. In 2007 was a very dark part of my life. For years, I was self-medicating with Xanax and alcohol, trying to manage my life with two children and the scars that I came home with my military sexual trauma. And I came home, and it got to a point where it was unmanageable. So at this time, I decided to take a full bottle of Xanax and drank a bottle of vodka. And I stood at the top of the stairs and decided that this was an easy way out for me. And I did. And I thought for sure it would kill me, but it didn't. Fortunately, my husband put me in a health care facility, and he managed my PTSD, thank God, through CBT and my children. But beyond that, I lived through it. And I became, out of this, a stronger person, and I became one of the best advocates I could think that I could become. And I went back to school for public policy because I felt that through public policy, I could help many veterans. And out of my pain, I don't tell a lot of people this, but I try to be that voice for very, very many out there that they don't have voices. And every district, veterans always find me on Facebook by the word of mouth. And I can't urge enough how important this bill is, because the 2% is, it would bring so many resources to not just suicides, education, I mean, nonprofits that actually reach out to veterans that struggle on a day-to-day basis. And I don't want to go on with this, but this was my story. And I appreciate every single one of you for listening to these stories today and how adamant this is. And I urge you to pass the 2%, please. Please. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Hess, committee. My name is Jeannie Clayton. I am a wife, mother, grandmother, and U.S. Navy veteran. I'm an American Legion Post's first ever women's veteran liaison out of McMinnville. I am here to ask you to support the bill that allows lottery funds to help local veterans programming, especially when they have proven that they work. I was helped by a veterans organization when I went through a VA program down in Temple, Texas for my military sexual trauma. They made us blankets. They brought us the things we needed on a daily basis, laundry soap, shampoo, razors, all of it. They helped us. When I returned home after the 7 weeks, I wanted my life to finally have a purpose, helping women veterans get the help that they need in a timely manner. It took me 31 years, and without the help of my community, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. Women are falling through the cracks. But thanks to Well Arts, Returning Veterans Projects, and Wise Counsel and Comfort, I and four other women veterans were given a platform to share our stories through theater. We wrote the Breaking Rank script being performed at the Milagro Theater through March in Portland. It's the first time that I have been able to be vulnerable in public since I was raped 31 years ago. These programs help me do that. Please allow the funding to come through. Us women are really, really falling through the cracks, and we need that extra help. And as mothers, a lot of times our husbands just up and leave because they can't deal with it anymore. But as a mom, we're the ones that are always sticking there and do everything we can for our kids and falling apart in front of them and nobody else around. It's either that or suicide, and I too have tried to commit suicide. And we need these resources so that we continue to heal. Thank you.
My name is Jason Carroll. I'm a combat veteran with 4 years service in Vietnam and tours in Somalia and Korea. I'm a past state commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I currently serve as our Veterans Service Committee chairperson. That is where our service office, which oversees our service office. Senator Blomquist had alluded to the fact that the issue with getting the funds from the Veterans Administration and getting the services, the benefits that the veterans have earned, largely relies on those service officers. Now, there are service officers for the state and the county service officers, but also veteran service organizations like the VFW have veteran service officers. We service all veterans. We don't just service VFW members, we service all veterans. We have a service office in Portland at the VA Regional Center, staffed with 2.5 persons. The point I want to make is that service office has a demand that far exceeds its capability. Our service officers are so busy that frequently they cannot even answer calls for people coming in. That's how high the demand is. There needs to be more service officers, and the only way they're going to get them is through funding like this. And I strongly urge that you pass this bill, and I would urge it to 2%, but whatever you can do is we need help, and we need help to help the veterans. And the best judge of how a claim is served by the Veterans Administration is how well it's prepared. And that relies on a qualified, dedicated service officer to do that. And that training, it takes about 3 years to really qualify a service officer. And so we need to keep those people in the system, and we need to have the resources to train them. With the VFW training, it's not an issue because our national does that. But with the county service officers and the state service officers, they do need training. And it takes funding to do that training.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Those are very compelling stories. And our hearts are going out to all of you and all vets that have those kind of stories. And
we're a work session.
I apologize to all of you who would like to hear and tell your story. We are just simply out of time, but I think you are lucky. You have a tremendous advocate up here on the dais with Senator Boquist, who I turn to now to make a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the dash 8 dated 2/25/16 into the main bill.
Senator Boquist moves dash 8 amendment into House Joint Resolution 202. Is there discussion on the motion?
No discussion.
Seeing none, the motion passes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 202 amended as the dash 8 to the floor with a do pass, and then I'll speak to the motion.
Senator Boquist moves House Joint Resolution 202 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're in the waning minutes here of the session and in hearings. It's a rare miracle that this bill got to where it is right now. We've gone back and forth at echelons well above us in the process. I would like to say the dash 8 makes 2%, and it would get all the way back across the other chamber and out the door before we walked out the door, but there's not been a guarantee of that. At 1.5%, we have the word of the speaker. And the president. And we don't need the governor to get this out as is. And if I'm able, I will carry it on the floor. But given the present situation, I'm not sure about that. But anyway, thank you.
Further discussion. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a really important bill, and I'm pleased that we're able to do this for our veterans. I am a veteran. I'm not a veteran of foreign wars. I've served in country here, and I was never in country over there. So those of you who were, I really appreciate what you've done, and I'm glad that we're able to help in our small way.
Further discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Metzger.
Yes.
Senator Edwards.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Yes.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yeah.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes yes. Measure carries. HJR 202 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation, and Senator Boquist will carry the bill. I'll close the work session and hearing, and we'll move down our schedule. And I'll open up a work session on House Bill 4146.
It's a tough day.
I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4146 and a work session on House Bill 4146.
Thank you.
I don't know the number. What's the number of the 4 years of the
year? Yeah. Thanks.
think you have the.
You have an amendment?
Yeah, that's the one. Let's have some kind of a briefing on that. Is that you or Paul?
Right, that's me.
Okay. Okay, we're going to get a briefing from Mazen on what the A9s do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first, the House Bill 4146 increases the transient lodging tax. And after doing that, it makes different changes in the way you distribute those revenues coming from the tax. In your package, you have an SMS that goes basically on a bit of history and so on of the tax and how it became through. But we'll not go through that. The only thing I'd like to share with you would be the presentation on the amounts, excuse me, and the numbers that you would see. This is the document in OLUS that is titled Lodging Tax 1%, and it has LRO Malik as the submitter, and this primarily shows you what under current law we have in the tax, and under current law you are looking at a 1% tax, and it goes about $17.1 million a year, and then the first biennium here we show in the 15-17 because the bill actually operates on the second year of the biennium, and it shows that how you get the allowance for collections and the 5% for the providers and 2% for the Department of Revenue. You end up with an amount on the available revenue, and then you have your distribution that is recommended at this point in current law to be at least or somewhere on the 15%. Under the proposal with this bill, you have these amounts changing in the distribution to have your regional distribution at 20%, and also establishes a new distribution of 10% for grants for the different programs in different areas or regions. And in that table, I have for you the increase of the 80%, which is the 0.8. increase of a full 1%, an increase in 50%. So your B9 actually takes a hybrid of these. It takes the 80% until the year 2022, which is the middle of the 21-23 biennium, and then it drops it back down to 1.5% or at the 50% level. And that is that biennium, half of the biennium, 21-23 going on. So that is what the bill with the B9 does for you.
Is the B9 dated today?
No, the B9 is dated. I think on the
225.
Rep. Nathanson, did you want to join us? I know we talked about this compromise, and it is indeed that, because nobody seems to be happy among proponents or opponents, but I know you and I had a brief chance to see if we can get there with this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative for House District 13. I did have remarks prepared and ready to present to this committee, but I assume time is of the essence. I just came over from a floor session in the House. How much time is available? Just
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
That's plenty.
I would love to give you my pitch for why I think this is important for the entire state, why the compromise that the House passed, which had ratcheted back the original proposal in
several different ways and added auditing and reporting and a number of other considerations. There had already been several compromises adopted in the House. So further compromises in the amount raised then erodes the ability to expand our economy in Oregon's seven regions. We know that this industry sector benefits rather immediately from every dollar we invest. $1 invested pays off in $11 in state and local tax revenue and many times over that in the multiplier effect. So we know that this is one industry sector which is responsive immediately. So in ratcheting it back over time does it give me pause. I have an amendment available that does two things. One is it's similar to the one that I heard you mention just now. The dash 11 reduces it to 1.5 after 5 years rather than 4 years, which allows for a little bit a gentler impact, if you will, and a longer time to spread an investment over. But it also incorporates an important technical fix that the bill drafter identified was needed, a technical fix in making sure that the reporting is happening on the entire amount. So the 11 incorporates those two things, just a difference of 1 year the time when it ramps down, and then also this technical fix. Yes, you're right. Compromises often mean that everyone's a little bit unhappy, but one would hope that we see that everyone has something to gain as well.
Thank you. You said it. I know the reporting is an issue, but I don't think it's one that should hold this up. We have weekends. Still change that in the future, and we do not, more importantly, have the paperwork ready to process that one.
There's a Scrivener's bill too, Mr. Chair. We could probably do the technical fix in the Scrivener's bill.
So that's where we are with 3 minutes left in this committee, and it goes without saying, appreciate your hard work on this. You've been working on this long before this session. This committee got this bill this week.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We in work session, Mr. Chair. We in work session. We want to
Representative McEwen, did you want to weigh in? We're just about ready to vote.
Pardon?
Yeah.
May I have just one moment, Senator?
Sure.
Okay.
We have 2 minutes and 30 seconds. You run out, I'm not making a motion.
So are we.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, thank you so much for indulging me. Just very briefly, my name is Catty McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast. And I've had the pleasure of testifying before this committee once before on this issue. And I just wanted to reiterate my very strong support representing our rural communities and the importance of this bill. I think in the form that Representative Nathanson has brought to you, I think the broad-based support for our rural communities for the seven regions that will benefit for this is critically important over a very long period of time. I think it's going to help prepare our communities ramp up to an event that we all think the folks that I represent are very important to this state. I think you heard me before mention that this is an opportunity of a generation to bring this event here, but there are long-term effects as well for all of us that live in rural communities. So I'll keep this very short and sweet and request that you seriously consider the form in which it was originally brought, which is now, well, been amended down to the 0.8% with the 20% designation to the seven regions that help us all that live out in the hinterlands to do really good work in attracting people to this state for a long period of time. So thank you so much, sir, for your indulgence.
Your representative. We are in a work session, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move the B-9 dated 2/225/16 into 4146B.
Senator Boquist moves the B-9s into House Bill 4146. Discussion. Objection.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Discussion. I think the B-11s are better. I don't like it's been hard to nail people down on who will vote for what. The process of trying to just talk with enough people to find out where they are, and everybody's pointing at, well, know, well, I'm hearing that they won't vote for this, and I'm hearing that they won't vote for that. I have been very frustrated as a legislator today, trying to run this down and knowing that there are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 amendments floating around out there, and we've only been working on paperwork for one of them, and it's basically the same as the 11s, with a year difference, and I'm expressing to you, Mr. Chair, I know that you're under the pressure of, you know, things come in and, you know, we're trying to get right a policy that is going to, you know, have a lot of consequences, and you've had a bunch of issues to deal with today, but the fact that we're blaming it on the clock and we don't have the paperwork really, really, really frustrates me. And the compromises, first of all, there were a bunch of compromises already embedded in the bill that came over from the House. Senate members may not be aware of it because they didn't work on it. And then to be compromising further, it gets more and more difficult to maintain the votes on concurrence the more that we compromise, and I'm worried about losing the whole thing. And so I guess I will probably support the nines, and I hope that it passes on concurrence, This is a process that I think is being unreasonably driven by the City of Portland and Travel Portland and Metro, and I've looked at the numbers, and I don't think that the request is reasonable, but I want the bill. I want the base bill, and so I'm prepared, just because we are at 3:03 on Friday. That's the only reason that I'm voting for this.
Fair enough. Further discussion? Seeing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move 4146B as amended by the B9s to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 4146 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
No.
Senator Edwards.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Boquist. No, thank you.
Chair
Hass. Hass votes aye. The measure passes. It goes to the floor of the Oregon Senate. Senator Edwards, I hear and feel your frustration. But would you like to carry this measure on the floor?
I guess.
Let the record show.
I'll co-carry with you.
Senator Edwards will carry the bill. We are due on floor. Thank you all for your patience on this bill and on the vets bill. And in the legislature, nobody gets everything that they want. We've said many times there's a graveyard right outside the Senate doors where perfect bills go to die. But these bills that we work on to get to the center and get to a compromise pass. So thank you all for your patience. We are adjourned.
All right.
We are adjourned.
All right.
Thank you all for your patience.